Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Marianne Mason is with us. Bill, you were talking about the perfect employee. Well, let's consider what perfect might be here.
Well, perfect for most employers means someone who is willing to work round the clock if necessary, to travel at the drop of a hat or handkerchief, and to really have their first priority is their workplace. And again, particularly these fast-track professions that I've been studying, the academic world and law and medicine and the corporate world, they really want to try you out at the very beginning. I call it the make-or-break years between the ages of 30 and 40, when most people have finished their training in law or academia or even in medicine, and they are about to launch into their career. And the first 10 years are always the most critical in terms of how they will fare. And if they fare well, then they will continue on the fast track. If they don't, then they will either be thrown out entirely, as there's an academic world where tenure is up or out, or they will be shunted to a second tier, to middle-level management, etc. For women, those are also the years, happily, I suppose, that they reproduce, if they reproduce at all. Most American women who are college-educated have their children after the age of 30 now. Mm. We've changed the clock in that direction, and partly because the training has become long and women are so engaged in the training and in the workplace. But it's a double whammy because during those 10 years, they have to do both.
And it is those 10 years.
Those 10 years.
30 to 40.
Exactly.
One could think, oh, yeah, those 10 years, 20 to 30, but that's not the case.
No, it's the 30 to 40, which is the critical decade. And it's the one in which I think if we're going to focus our attention in terms of workplace reforms or any kind of personal or structural changes, that's the decade in which we're losing women. We have very clear evidence that that's when the pipeline starts to lose the best and brightest women, or many of the best and brightest women.
We did some benchmarking a few years back, within the last decade, principally around gender in the corporate environment. And what we thought we found, and I don't think this is discrepant, but it's a little different, is there was a line of women by age. Above that, they were essentially assimilationists. They had become, if they had reached senior levels, they were assimilationists. They had adopted the mannerisms, the string ties, the suits, all of those things. Below that, there was a fairly substantial, in fact, Deloitte & Touche, which you mentioned
yes.
at some length, was one of those companies that was trying to overcome that. Below that, there were a lot of women that were getting up to that and leaving. And part of what appeared to be happening, the way we interpret it, was a lot of them, and this goes to the perfect employee, got to that point, realized what was involved, what the rewards were, what the payoff was, and what the cost was.
Yes.
And just said, this isn't worth it.
Yes.
In terms of living my life.
And yes.
We're exiting, not necessarily, I mean, they weren't going home necessarily. They were starting their own businesses.
Right.
They were doing a lot of different things.
Right.
But they were, in this case, walking out of the corporate environment.
Right. I think they walk out of the corporate environment because this isn't working. And our research shows that it's largely because they have family concerns. Either I want to have a family or I already have a child. And it's true, they don't walk out. They don't stay at home. The notion of women opting out and staying at home happily is really not the reality. First of all, women can't even afford to stay at home. But if they could, they still have been well-trained and they have ambition and they want to do something. So certainly in the corporate world, most new businesses now are started by women. And usually small businesses, they become the entrepreneurs of the corporate world, or they'll do consulting. What they don't do, though, is stay in those big corporate models and become the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, because those corporate worlds are not going to let them do that on their schedule that they need to have when they're between 30 and 40 or 45. With a more flexible workplace, which is really what you said, Deloitte & Touche did, their aim was to retain women. And to do this, they offered enormous amount of flexibility at all times in life, but particularly in the years that I'm talking about when they had small children. And they managed to have more than 90% retention rate and have a very, very profitable outcome from this.
And their intention was not just to keep women. What they really wanted, I mean, this was a business decision.
Yes.
Exactly. They just weren't being good guys.
Yes.
Exactly. What they realized is that they were losing half of the intellectual brain.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
They had a tremendous investment
into these
young people who were coming out well-trained
yes.
from their schooling. That they had pumped lots of energy and money and resources into these people.
Yes.
And it was very, very costly to them. So yes, they're a nice company, and the strict business sense of this, which to us looked like a perfectly reasonable thing for a business to be considering. Yes. And it would seem to me that that's some of what needs to be examined as you're looking across the academy, academia, medicine, law, and the corporate world, that there are real costs to not paying attention to your women.
Yes, and I think part of the problem there is, in the academic world, you can see those real costs very directly, because you're the ones who are educating and doing the training, which is very costly. And then they go on to start their job somewhere else, so they don't necessarily see the whole cost. The corporation or the university doesn't see the whole cost of that particular training. But what they're losing is enormous amount of talent that someone else has trained in many cases. Or in the university world, they're losing the very same people they've trained, which is particularly dumb. You take a class and have 50% of all PhDs today are women, and yet you see 20% in the professoriate at the major universities, and they're just losing it entirely in terms of making a good economic bet on these women.
In addition to the intellectual capital,
yes,
the social capital.
Yes.
Well, corporations, in my experience, are, well, I was going to say they're the worst about it, but universities have their own challenges, too.
Yes.
These are monocultures, and as much as anything, it's not a word I think that you use, but essentially they're, these are monocultures. There's one way to do it. There is a standard model, white, male, something, driven, whatever.
Yes.
But there's a neat set of categories, or a fairly straightforward set of categories. And as much as anything, the real loss is in that broadening the culture, mm-hmm. particularly as we have to engage and do business and communicate across broad cultures in a relatively dynamic environment, not to have to insist on maintaining a monoculture, which is what happens if you don't change the structural things that you point to.
Yes.
And it seems to me, both in terms of the effectiveness of the institution, whether it's economic effectiveness or the quality of the teaching or whatever, but also in terms of the culture itself, the broader culture, the community, that's what really matters in this, is the opportunity to learn from a lot of different experiences and a lot of different perspectives.
Yes, on all fronts. These cultures have changed somewhat, but more often to the worse. At the universities, for instance, now most undergraduate classes are taught by part-time or adjuncts, and these are primarily the women they've trained as PhDs. Because they, they can get them cheaper, and the women have no choice but to take these jobs or nothing at all. So it's a very exploited labor class. Similarly, in law firms, only 16% of partners in major law firms are women, even though they start out with about the same number of associates going through the track. But they will often keep women as contract lawyers or non-equity partners, and basically have created a second tier, which is in a business model, they think they're getting cheap labor, but what they're getting is a very underutilized and very dissatisfied second tier.
And the dissatisfaction has its costs as well.
Of course it does. They're not going to be ideal employers. They're going to be very angry employees, or at least at best, they'll just do their job and go home. They will not give it the full attention that they would if they actually were part of the regular track.
As if they were a part of what?
As if they were part of the mainstream track of the university or of corporation.
Thank you.
Part of the fast track.
You say that in most urban areas, you cannot raise a child on a single income.
Yes.
Which, everything else aside, says that, the argument, the neo-mamanistas...
What?
The new momism... would they have you believe that this is optional and that women are working because they want their fingernails painted or something? But I had not seen it quite that starkly put, that if you're going to raise children at a certain level, and presumably this is not an extravagant level, in an urban environment, which increasingly is where people live, that a single income is simply not sufficient. This is not optional.
No, it's not optional. And women who are in those situations might leave jobs for which they were well-trained and doing brilliantly and take a really second tier or some... Often they'll work from home or do consulting, not use their talents because they can't afford not to work in some way or another, but they certainly aren't getting the most out of the workplace. They're not giving the most to the workplace, and the workplace is suffering.
There's another piece that you go by, you don't confront it directly because that's not what this book is about. We every now and then argue about healthcare in this country, and we have chosen to tie healthcare and pensions to the job,
yeah.
Which, you know, we sort of take for granted because that's the way it's always been around here. But it seems to me that that's a really important part of this, because if the only way you can get health insurance, as an example, at a time of escalating costs, if the only way you can get pension benefits is through your work, then you are coerced into taking a job, regardless, simply in order to have the benefits.
Yes. All of which we will discuss when we come back in just a moment. Your timing was impeccable. We'll be back in a moment.
I try.
With Mary Ann Mason. Be with us when we return.